Continuing on in our text, we are in 2 Kings chapter 17, and we looked last time at the fall of Samaria, the northern kingdom, and that's still where we're at because we didn't completely cover everything. The last king of the northern kingdom was a fellow by the name of Hoshea. And the king of the southern kingdom is a guy named Hezekiah. We haven't been introduced to him yet by the chronicler, but we will be very soon. He's kind of a familiar name because he gets mentioned in Isaiah the prophet quite a bit. All these happenings are recorded in Isaiah the prophet as well. The fall of Samaria, and some other things that are going to happen to Judah here as we go on, Isaiah the prophet writes about. So I think it really is important that we remember that these three prophets, especially Hosea and Micah, are all writing at this same time. They're writing about these events. And so when you read those prophets, you know you're getting another side of the story of what's going on here. And what they are writing about ties into these events. So understanding the prophets means you have to understand the history that's going on alongside them. So we can just try to think in those terms. When I was teaching the prophets course at Appalachian Bible College, one of the things I tried to get my students to do was memorize the lines of Kings and try to remember the names of all the kings through Israel so that they could piece these things together and kind of remember some of the events that were going on. Why would it be important that Hosea the prophet, God tells him, go marry this prostitute. She's going to be unfaithful to you, but I want you to keep pursuing her. Why would that be an important message at this point in time? Yeah, because the prostitute represents Israel. And so even though Israel is going to be deported from the land, what is God saying through Hosea the prophet? What was Hosea supposed to do? No, he didn't cut her up. That's a different account. I think you're thinking of back in Judges. He was commanded to keep pursuing her. Go after her and bring her back. So that message is hugely important because as Israel is being deported from the land by the Assyrians, God is, through Hosea, preaching this message of, I'm going to pursue you and I'm going to bring you back. Even though you're running off after all these other gods, you're committing adultery with all these other gods, I'm going to pursue you because you're mine. And so that message of faithfulness by God couldn't have been missed, couldn't have been lost on them. But they are in the middle of some horrific events. I think when we left off with them, we were talking about the sieging of Israel, of Samaria. So when we bring our map up here, we'll zoom in just a little bit so that we can get an idea of where things are. This is the region of Samaria up here. This is the city of Samaria. It's kind of buried under all those other names there. But remember that all of this land of Galilee, all the land of Ramoth-Gilead, and much of the land down here of the Philistines has already fallen to the Assyrians. They've captured all of it. And so Hosea, the king of Samaria, is holed up in this city, and that's all that's left. There is no more land outside of the city that belongs to him. He's king just about in name only. And so this massive army of Assyrians is surrounding him. And how long do they siege the city? It's in chapter 17, verse 6. Well, actually, you'd have to delve in a little bit. Verse 5.
3 years.
3 years. What would Mendota be like if we shut off all the roads into it after 3 years?
Not very good.
I mean, let's close off every road coming in. 251, 34, 39, they're all shut off. We've got armies guarding them.
Be a dead town.
Okay, let's shut off the trains too. No more trains coming through. What else? Yeah, we do have an airport. No airlifting. You'd be bored and hungry. That is a very good description of what happens during a siege. Well, it would make the days be awfully long, right, with nothing to occupy your mind from your hunger. I mean, there's very little left to eat. We're going to get to one siege. It's not this one, but there's another siege that comes up that's described. And it says that a donkey's head was selling for, I forget what it was, this outrageous price, like 30 shekels of silver. Have you ever eaten donkey head? Have you ever been, let me ask you it this way, have you ever been hungry enough that you said, that sounds good? Eldon? That's right. But when you're that hungry, the Proverbs say, to a hungry man, every bitter thing is sweet. You know, when you're hungry enough, you will eat. How hungry would I have to be to eat a spider? Whew.
No,
not I don't know. I don't know. I think I could do worms and bugs and beetles first, but not spiders. So, or snakes, right, Eldon? We've got to manage that snake population, but you can imagine even after 3 years in this city, there would not have been all that much vermin left. People would have been catching them and eating them. Jim, go ahead.
I'm reading about some of the prisoners in World War II, Japanese prison camps.
Oh, yeah.
They used to fight over catching a rat.
Yeah.
They said they were pretty good. They tasted like sweet and sour pork, but I don't want to track that out.
Yeah, but that's the point you get to, isn't it? So 3 years the city's been shut up, and then it says in the ninth year of Hosea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria, and that ends the northern kingdom as a separate entity. He hauls off all the people to Assyria, and he says he places them in the in Hala, on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. So, in order to get an idea of where he is relocating these people, because this was the Assyrians' standard method of controlling their conquered peoples. So you can imagine, we're surrounded for 3 years, and finally the enemy conquers the walls of Mendota. I know, we don't have any walls, but we've built walls just beforehand to try to stop them. They come pouring in the walls, they round up all the people in the city, they gather us up, and they say, I'm moving you guys to Pennsylvania. You're going to go live there.
Yay.
And so, yay. Well, for you guys, you've lived in Pennsylvania. Chicago? Yeah, that's true. That's like a foreign place, isn't it? He moves us to all the cities of Chicago. Yeah. You go from this place like Israel, which was very, very fertile ground, and you move to some place completely foreign. Completely. They didn't even speak your language. They drop you right in the middle of Pittsburgh, and how are you going to know what a sandwich is? Or when someone says, what do yins want? You going to know what they mean?
Yes.
Yeah? Or they tell you, you need to go downtown for that. Yeah. They speak a whole different language. I'm teasing Pittsburghese, and Kim's probably listening over there. But, they're taking you to a whole different place. So let me zoom out, and we're going to get an idea of how far away this place is. Here we are. Okay. Scroll over this way. It is all part of the Fertile Crescent, yeah. So here's Israel. You can see Egypt down here and Sinai Peninsula. This is Arabia down to the south here. This whole area here is nothing but desert. You don't go through there. So if you think the quickest way from one point to another is a straight line, that's true. But if you draw the straight line from where they are here in Samaria to where they're going, the Medes live over this direction. Okay, Babylon's down here, where the Tigris and Euphrates River converge. This is called the Fertile Crescent, this area. All right, Tigris and Euphrates rivers flow up this way and form a very, very fertile valley down here. You can see the green. But you can't cut straight across here because this is the Arabian Desert. That's certain death to go through there. So they have to march all the way north into Syria, and then they come back down through the capital, Nineveh, which is the capital of the Assyrian Empire, and down Babylon again is over this way, but the cities of the Medes is over here. If you keep going to the, what direction is that? If you keep going to the east, you'll wind up in Persia. But the cities of the Medes is this way. So you come over here to this kind of mountainous land, and you were from the hilly region of Samaria, very fertile land of Galilee. It's a very, very different place. So you can imagine by the time they've marched all this distance and been relocated, they are completely and totally demoralized. There's no more fight left in them. And that was the idea behind the Assyrians and their relocations. So they would move the people groups around so that you're no longer on your own home turf. You don't have that advantage any longer. And so what kind of motivation would you have to rise up in revolt against this new Assyrian government? Not a whole lot. Now, first of all, your army's been completely destroyed. Secondly, you're no longer on your own home soil, so you're not defending your home. And thirdly, you're in a place you can barely even speak to people. Eldon. Yeah, we did. Yes. Yep, it's been a strategy many, many times throughout history. Trouble is, it's kind of effective in subduing people groups, and so it gets done over and over again. It's not a good thing to do, but that's how they did it. And so he tells us there, they marched them away, they placed them in Hala on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Medes. And so this is where they're at, is up here. Actually, if you just cross, I think that's, is that the, no, this is the Black Sea over here. I'm not sure what this sea is, but Caspian Sea. Thank you. Guess what's right up here? That's Russia. In the Old Testament, it's called Rosh. Okay. And so they are not that far from Russia. I mean, Siberia is quite a ways if you're thinking of the cold, wintry place, but, no, Georgia's south of Tennessee. It might be, Gary. It might be called. No, not anymore.
They were.
Is Kazakhstan over there? Because over here is Ukraine, I think.
There's several countries over there where the last part of the name was stamped.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm trying to think. There's not three of them.
Yeah, well, my geography of the former Soviet Union is not as good as probably should be, but that's kind of the idea of where they're at. You can go over here to Persia, you can come up here along the side of the Caspian and enter what was called Rosh, but you're definitely in a very, very foreign place. And the idea was no more fight left in you because you're not defending your home turf anymore. You're not defending your own culture anymore. Your culture has been obliterated. There's nothing left of it. And so we're trying to force these people to integrate and to meld themselves into the people group into whom they have been planted. Now, the Jewish people didn't do that very well. In some ways, they melded. In some ways, they kind of kept their own communities. But that's the idea behind this. So when we get into verse 7 and we start going down through here, we're going to get into what every modern historian would say ruins the book of Kings as being a good piece of history. Because what's the job of a historian? To get things right. In other words, to report the facts, the truth, right? Is a historian supposed to try to interpret what happened? They do anyway, don't they? Every historian does to some degree. But here, we're going to get an interpretation of the events that we have been studying over the last several years. But here's the fun thing. Whose interpretation are we getting? We're getting God's. We're getting God's perspective on history. We're getting God telling us why these events happened, what brought them to pass. So we're not left to wonder and look at trends and say, well, this led to that, and that could have led to this. You know, we can do that with modern history. You know, what caused World War I? What caused World War II? We know there's a lot of multifaceted things that go into those studies. But when we look at this event in Israel's history and future deportation that's going to happen to Judah, these next 20 verses or so tell us why. They tell us exactly why these things happened. So, verse 7, this occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods. I'm going to pause there. This sentence goes on and on and on. Why does the historian give us that line? Okay, they've sinned against the Lord their God who brought them up out of the land of Egypt from the hand of Pharaoh. Eldon? That is true. We are subject to a judgment if we don't live obediently. Why the rehearsing of the Exodus? Why does he remind them of the fact that God brought Israel out of Egypt? Yeah, they were slaves in Egypt. So they're supposed to look at this and say, yeah, look where we were. And God delivered us from that. God brought us out of slavery from under the hand of Pharaoh. He made us a nation. He gave us a land. He gave us a law. And what did we do with it? We ignored it. We squandered it. You know, one time when I was a kid, I was kind of being a kid. My grandpa gave each of us, of the grandkids, a couple of bucks. I think it was like $5 or $6. It wasn't a huge amount of money, but I mean, for a kid, and at that time, it wasn't a small amount of money either. You know what I did with it? Me and my buddy Jason buried it in the middle of the woods in a little box, and we made a map to it because we thought it would just be the coolest thing in the world to have a hidden treasure. We'll come back and get it later. Only, you know what happened? I lost the map. And you'd think I could remember where it was buried. But do you think I remembered where it was buried? Only roughly. But do you know how much dirt is in like a 10-foot radius if you can't remember where something's buried? Okay? And so when my grandpa found out about that, he came to visit a second time and he started asking, you know, what the kids had done with the money. And my brother was like, well, I did this. And my sister says I did this. And he looked at me and said, what'd you do with your money? You know, I wish I'd have told him that. I lied. I said, oh, I kind of lost it. I don't know what happened to it. Oh, boy, the look on disappointment on Grandpa's face. I was like, I gave you that gift, and you did what with it? And I think when he found out that I was lying and that I had actually hidden it in the woods, he wasn't any happier that I had just buried it in the ground. Yeah, he didn't quite fulfill that parable. But he did. The next time he was giving out a little bit of money to the grandkids, he handed each of my brother and sister a couple dollars, and I didn't get any. So he was so disappointed. Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. He couldn't trust me. But did I ever find the money? I did, yes. My friend Jason was able to go back and find the money and got it back to me. But that idea of squandering, of wasting, is the idea that they're bringing out here. Look what God did for you. He brought you out of Egypt. He gave you a land. He gave you a law. He made you a people. He made you His own people. And what did you do with it? You didn't listen to any of it. And so the rest of the chapter is going to be this list of grievances that God, the landowner, has against the tenants. You remember the parable of the tenants that Jesus gives? Same idea is going on here. God is the landowner. The law is the lease. Israel is the tenants. This is the eviction notice. What did you do wrong? So you feared other gods and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel, and in the customs of the kings of Israel had practiced. And the people of Israel did secretly against the Lord their God things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. So, everywhere, they're violating which commandments? So far. The first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. Right. No other gods before me. And what does that before mean? Not my kids. He's first? So, as long as we have Him first, we can have other gods second, third, and fourth? Okay. Only, there you go, right. Before me means in my presence. You will have no other gods in my presence at all. And it is that idea, God is God alone, worship no other gods at all. Especially when you're talking about in my land, you don't worship other gods. It's kind of that thing people tell their kids sometimes. As long as you're in my house, you obey my rules. And that's what God is telling them here. Now, Paul makes it very, very clear to us that though the Ten Commandments and the law of Moses applied to Israel in the land, the purpose behind the law was to convict the entire world of sin. So when he commanded Israel, don't worship other gods, he was also telling the rest of the world, don't worship other gods. So don't worship other gods, but you have. Don't make any graven images. But they did. You guys have built high places everywhere, from watchtowers to fortified cities. So where are the watchtowers at? Where do you build a watchtower? Yeah, out in the middle of nowhere, right? It's a place that you're not, doesn't feel like it's under much threat, but you want to keep an eye on it. So out in the middle of nowhere, it's kind of like the, what do they call them? Fire. Do they build fire towers around here? Watchtowers for fires? Yeah? Okay. You know, out in Pennsylvania, they're all over the place. So you go to the top of a hill, and there'll be this big, tall tower, and they're watching for forest fires, and they man them. And that's the idea. You have this watchtower so you can look around, make sure no bad guys are coming. But what did they do on those watchtowers? They put idols in them. So that while you're up there protecting the land and watching it, you can be worshiping whatever god you want to. So the people of Israel, they did secretly against the Lord their God things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they made offerings on all the high places as the nations did before whom the Lord carried away before them. They did wicked things, provoking the Lord to anger, and they served idols of which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this. So here again, just repeating this charge, you've built asherim. You've built idols. You've done this on all the high watchtowers. You've done it on every high hill. You've done it under every green tree. So you can imagine Israel looked like a very spiritually minded place when you went into it. There's temples to the gods all over the place. Is it a good thing for people to be spiritually minded? It depends on what you mean by spiritual, doesn't it? It absolutely does depend on what you mean by spiritual. So our world celebrates spirituality, and we have to be careful not to say, oh, that's great. I mean, because when we say spirituality, we mean one thing. But when the world says spirituality, they mean something completely different. Eldon?
Well, they had all the zeal, but they had pointed in the wrong direction.
Absolutely, yeah. All their zeal pointed in the wrong direction. So they're provoking the Lord to anger by serving these idols. Verse 13, yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah by every prophet and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes in accordance with all the law that I commanded your fathers and that I sent to you by my servants, the prophets. So we've been reading about some of the prophets. We've been talking about Isaiah and Micah and Joel and Jonah. And even going back farther, we can talk about Elisha and Elijah and Samuel and even David. All of these men and many, many more, God had been sending into the country of Israel saying, turn away from this, stop doing this, and turn back to me. The message of the prophets was continually, primarily, about returning to the covenant. Now, when we think of prophet, we tend to think of prediction of the future. Because that's sort of what we have attached to the idea of a prophet. You're a prophet, that means you can tell the future. But really, only a very small part of prophecy has to do with the future. Most of the Old Testament prophets are sermons calling Israel back to covenant faithfulness. It's God sending his messengers saying, repent, turn away from your idol worship and come back to worshiping Jehovah. Only a small part of them actually talk about the future. Now, those times when God does peel back that veil of the future, those are important because he does tell us some pretty significant things. When he does peel back the veil and starts telling us about future things, it almost always has to do with the Messiah. Okay. Rarely, very rarely, does God peel back that veil of the future and tell us things that don't connect with the Messiah. And usually they somehow connect in a sideways way. But that's God. He does tell us occasionally. The one thing he does name in the book of Isaiah, right about this time when he's telling Israel, you're getting kicked out of the land because of your sin. But he says, I'm going to bring you back. And guess what the guy's name is that I'm going to use to do it? His name is Cyrus. And I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to tell you his name 400 years before he's even born, so that you know that I'm the one bringing you back and it's not these idols of yours. Because who can declare the end from the beginning? Nobody but God can do that. So, come back. I've sent all these prophets. So I haven't just been sitting here idle. I haven't just been sitting here letting you go your own way. I've been warning you. I've been telling you. You need to come back to me. Verse 14, but they would not listen. They were stubborn as their fathers had been, who did not believe in the Lord their God. How far does that go back? How far does the stubbornness of Israel go back? All the way back to Exodus, right. When did they first start grumbling against God? Yeah, it was like they weren't even across the sea yet. You remember when they're all standing there on the edge of the sea and they hear Pharaoh's chariots coming up behind them? They all start yelling at Moses, oh, it'd be better for us to go back into slavery than to die here out in the wilderness. And say, I'm sorry, didn't you just see everything that happened to Egypt? Did you miss the darkness and the frogs and the flies and the death of the firstborn? Were you not paying attention to all this stuff? You want to go back there? You want to be slaves again? Some of them probably still had scars on their backs, open wounds on their back from the whips of Egyptian taskmasters. And yet they start crying, I want to go back, I want to go back. How often do people run back to sin because it's more comfortable? A lot. And it's easier. Slavery to sin oftentimes is very comfortable, very easy, very prosperous. And what's that? It's habit, yeah. And so we get used to it. And we kind of somewhere know in our hearts and minds that this isn't the way it's supposed to be, but, you know, it's easier than fighting it. And that's where Israel was. And so all the way back to the very beginning, their fathers were stubborn, and that continued on down here for, it was 1495 was the Exodus, and we're in 722. So we're about 800 years later. I mean, how many generations have passed, and yet this just generational problem of stubbornness is still going on. They wouldn't listen. They were stubborn. Verse 15, they despised his statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers and the warnings that he gave them. Isn't that a tough word to swallow? When you disobey God's commands, he calls it you've despised them. You've hated them. You've rejected them. Oh, no, Lord, it's not that. How many people have you talked to throughout your life? Oh, yeah, I love God. I love him, but never do what he says. Never even try. It's because at heart, there is that stubbornness. There is that rejection of him. They went after false gods and became false. You know, you become like the God you worship. If the God you worship loves to kill children, guess where your heart will wind up. If the God you worship is just after money, guess where your heart will wind up. If the God you worship is the God of the Bible, guess what you start to become. You become like him. You become righteous. You start to become holy because you're pursuing that God. So they pursued false gods, so they became false. And they followed the nations that were around them, concerning whom the Lord had commanded them that they should not do like them. And they abandoned all the commandments of the Lord their God and made for themselves metal images of two calves. That's the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. That's what's been in the northern kingdom since its beginning. Okay. The two calves. And they made an Asherah and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. Baal's the storm god of the Canaanites. Asherah was his wife. Do you know we have found inscriptions on clay tablets and things that say this pot was devoted to Jehovah and his Asherah? And so that bad theology crept into Israel where they started thinking, well, Baal has a wife. I guess Jehovah probably has one too. And they started corrupting the image of the immortal God and made him like the images of the other gods that they had made for themselves. Verse 17, if you think that's bad enough, they burned their sons and their daughters as offerings. We talked about that a little bit. Several of the gods of the nations around Israel loved this kind of thing. That really showed your devotion. If you loved that God a lot, you were willing to give up your most valuable thing for it, your own kids. And so they would burn them on those altars. They used divinations and omens and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. About 50 years ago, we found a library buried in the dirt over in, it was up north here in Syria, but we found this library buried in the dirt, and it was a Canaanite library, and we found thousands of clay tablets in there describing the practices that they did in service to their gods, like Baal. And it describes all the divinations in there. They had encyclopedias full of how to interpret sheep's livers. So if you wanted to practice divination, we've probably heard of sayings like reading the tea leaves. And they had prescriptions for all these things. So you mix up the tea leaves in the water, sprinkle the tea leaves in, and the patterns that they make are supposedly tell you something about what the gods intend to do. Or if you would sacrifice a sheep, take out its liver and look at the shape of it. And they had encyclopedias full of information on how to interpret sheep's livers. Or they had all kinds of other things that were part of divination. And so Israel was buying into these things. Israel was practicing these things because they were trying to determine what these other gods wanted. It's the funny thing, because when you get into looking at the other gods that are around Israel, the idea is you never really were quite sure what they wanted. They might be angry at you. So if your crops go badly one year, it's probably because Baal, the storm god, is mad at you for some reason, but you would never know why. You just had to sacrifice to him, and hopefully that would appease him. Is that what the God of the Bible is like? No. He tells us exactly what it is he wants us to do, doesn't it? He tells us ahead of time what are the rewards and what are the punishments, especially when you get into the law. And it wasn't hard things to understand. It's really not hard to understand commandments like, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make to yourselves any graven image. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother. Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Don't murder. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't covet. Those are not difficult concepts to understand. And yet, the people were obsessed with trying to figure out what all these other gods wanted when God, Jehovah God, had given them a very clear description in his word of what he wanted. And they provoked him to anger. Verse 18, therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel, and he removed them out of his sight. None was left but the tribe of Judah only. So this is that description of the deportation of the northern tribes. They have been evacuated out of the land, and they've been taken away to those other places that we talked about. So you'd say, well, Judah's left. That must mean Judah's doing great, right? Now, we've been studying Judah as we've been going along. Most of the kings were righteous, but several of them were wicked scoundrels. And the ones that were righteous weren't exactly totally righteous. Excuse me. Who was the most righteous king of the northern kingdom thus far? David. Was he a totally, completely righteous guy? No, he wasn't, because he has that one incident with Bathsheba and Uriah, right? So that even tells us that even though the southern kingdom is more faithful, they are not 100% faithful. They're still guilty. So verse 19, Judah also did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the customs that Israel had introduced. And the Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel and afflicted them and gave them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them out of his sight. That's the northern kingdom, cast out of his sight now. When he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord, made them commit great sin, those two calves. And the people of Israel walked in all the sins that Jeroboam did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his servants the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria unto this day. Eldon. It did, very much.
They were told not to have foreign wives. And this is the reason. God gave that instruction. And Solomon did not obey it.
No, Solomon didn't obey the commands either, did he? He was told not to multiply wives. How many did he have? Yeah, it's like 700 wives, 300 concubines. Yeah. You know, all over the place we look and see, Israel did not follow the terms of the covenant. And so this is God's statement as to why these events in history happened. So historians can look at it and say some other thing. Well, they weren't strong enough to defend themselves or whatever it is. But here is God's statement on why. Here's God's statement on why this happened. It's because they disobeyed me, so I kicked them out of the land. Verse 24, the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. So not only does he take the Israelites and he moves them all over to the cities of the Medes, but he brings people from all over the rest of the empire, mixes them together, and brings them to Samaria. And resettles Samaria with all of these foreigners, and so they lived there. And we get this really interesting account here. I know I was going to get to the beginnings of the Samaritans today, but we've got a lot of the chapter left here to try to cover as we look at the beginning of Samaria. So we'll have to cover that next time. Any questions about what we did cover tonight?